I'm Bailey Parnell, and this is Let's Think This Through. Join me for drinks as I bring on guests for conversations that inspire, amuse, and challenge us, but in a fun and relaxing kind of way. Ultimately, it's to help us all learn and live a better, easier life. So let's think this through. Good morning, my thinking buddies for today. I met this next guest at a holiday party for public speakers. And these parties are always so interesting and honestly really quite bizarre. They're almost like straight out of a sitcom, I swear to you. You literally meet people where it's like, oh, I climb seven mountains. Oh, I'm an Olympian. Oh, I research XYZ. And I was a politician or a news anchor. It's just so all over the place. You have to laugh sometimes. But one thing that is really great about these is that you know that everyone has a story, and you already know that everyone is willing to talk about something for a while. So the next guest and I, though, we realized pretty quickly that we fit into, dare I say, the same category, the entrepreneur, researcher, practitioners, and that within that world, we actually shared a lot of common subjects, education, technology, AI, and so we just had to meet up. And we did. We had that first 30-minute meetup, and it was so good, and it was too short. And I said right then and there, you just have to come on the podcast because there is just so much that we have to think through together in an unconstrained way. So that's what's going to happen today. On today's episode, I will be going for drinks with Duane Matthews. Duane, welcome to Let's Think This Through.
Thank you very much for having me.
I am very glad to continue this conversation that we last had on here and have a little bit more time to get through it. But how are you introducing yourself to the people these days when they say, you know, what do you do?
You know what? I try my very best not to be too long-winded because I'm introverted. I'll start with this. So my name is Duane Matthews. Once upon a time, I used to be a teacher. I taught grades 3, 4, 5, 6, a little bit of library. I did that here in Toronto. And I also did that in Lima, Peru for a number of years. While I was in Lima, Peru, I also did strategic planning. And, you know, on a really cool trip to the jungle, I had an epiphany and decided that I was going to leave education and go into the world of technology transfer and technology scouting. And what we did was we looked for any kind of technology that was going to shift paradigms and shift economy. And after going through that experience, I exited that company in 2012. I realized that much of education and a lot of work, actually, people were not really prepared for the kind of intersectionality that was being created by technology, and I should focus my lens on education. So I spend time speaking to elementary schools, post-secondary education schools, and sometimes a number of executives at companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is going to be a fun conversation because I know that we have a lot of overlap, but what are you drinking this evening?
So this evening you called me in, and it's Friday evening. Friday, I usually like to sit back and relax. So I usually do that with a vodka and soda. How about yourself?
Cheers then. I am doing an espresso martini sans alcohol because I'm not drinking right now, but I still like to bring just as much party.
Okay, there you go.
So cheers to you. Okay, so last time we talked, we started this just before we were recording, but you mentioned that you were going through a transition. And that you were taking a trip, or that your family was taking a trip. So did you have any realizations? Because I've been thinking about it ever since. Did you have any of those kind of reflective moments?
So I've been on one trip, and then my family is actually just coming back from another trip. And I did have some reflections. I was born here. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago. And I can tell you a little bit about that experience as to why I usually like to go there to have the reflections. But when I was a young boy, I spent my summers with my grandmother. So I'm from a single mother family. And so during the summer, when I was home, my mom would send me to stay with my grandparents. And my grandparents lived on an oil refinery in Trinidad and Tobago in a compound, they call it, that was called Carib Valley. Mm-hmm. And so this compound was where a number of expatriates would live, but the oil company was switched to a national oil company and all the expatriates left. My grandparents still had a place there. So I would go spend these summers. It was an absolutely beautiful place with maybe about 30 to 40 houses and these big giant banyan trees. I don't know if you know what those are, but the trees are really big and wide and hang over. Very, very beautiful. And on one side was the ocean, and on the other side was this sort of manicured sort of wonderland, but there were no other people.
Oh, wow.
So every day, my grandmother would tell me to go out on my bike and just go riding and come back at lunch, and I'd come back for lunch, and then I would go back out and come back when the streetlights got dark. So I spent my whole day, my whole summer, sort of sitting under a tree, staring out at the ocean, falling asleep, waking up, but being very reflective. And so when I go back to Trinidad and Tobago, if I can find a place, I find I do my best reflection there. And so to your question, what are some of the things that I've thought about? I've thought about the fact that we are at an inflection point in society where we're switching from one S-curve to the next. And the last time we did anything that profound as a species was 1871.
So why don't you, so first off, everyone listening, when Dwayne is in Toronto, correct?
That is correct.
So you're in Toronto, and tell us about the S-curves and what was happening back then and what's happening now. And what is the S-curve?
Sure. So once upon a time, our economy was based on agriculture. And so 98% of all people were in farming. And the economy was essentially flat. It didn't really do anything. The only way that an economy grew is if somebody had a really big army and they went to somebody else's space and took their stuff. And the main sort of generator of labor in the Western Hemisphere was slavery. In 1863, slavery was abolished. And after 1863, somewhere around 1870 to 1871, we had the advent of compulsory education at scale. And so this has kind of been growing for the last couple of years. And what happened was, today, about 2% of people in North America are farmers, and across the planet, about 26%. And we actually have exponentially more food with more people, even though we do have some challenges around distribution. And we had an explosion of work. So work as we know it in offices. And I mean, if you really think about what the vast majority of people do in an office, it really is digital interactions going back and forth.
Totally.
To generate value. And so I can imagine in 1870 going to a farmer and saying, I'm going to take your four sons, your three daughters, and they're going to go to school. They're going to get physically weaker. They're not going to be moving their bodies. They're going to have to sit for 6 hours, and the entire world is going to be dramatically better, and we're all not going to starve to death. I can imagine how crazy that is. And so my reflection is, we are at this moment again in society where we're faced with a convergence of a number of different technologies that are shifting us from one economic reality to something that we can't see, and we're feeling a massive amount of trepidation, stress, anxiety about the coming transition. And I thought, that's a really interesting reflection, and how could I help people with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, no small feat. Is this what you do at your business then? Because I don't normally start with my guests' business or wares, but I actually think that for yours, it will set up the conversation quite nicely for today. So is this what you do at Tomorrow Now then? Have these kinds of consults and insights?
Sure. And that's precisely it. So I'm an advisor to a number of leaders. I like to have a small pool of leaders, no more than 20 at a time. And most of those leaders, I'm an advisor confidentially. And what I help with is strategy and future casting. So how does a leader position their company? How do they start planning? And how do they start doing that without losing confidence, trust, and optimism from, it could be shareholders, stakeholders, employees, et cetera? How do they have those reflective conversations? And I do that all the way from school, all the way up into work.
Right, because I saw that a lot of your focus is on the education space and the future of education. So is Tomorrow Now advising then, theoretically, the future of education?
Yes. So I spend a significant amount of time with directors of education, with heads of state, with ministers, speaking about how do you connect education to future prosperity.
Well, what motivated you to get into this?
So when I had the experience of technology scouting, I had a number of really interesting experiences. You know, we did projects with large oil and gas companies. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting from the large oil and gas companies was, you know, this is back in 2012 when people were saying, hey, there's no such thing as climate change. It's all a hoax. And then the oil companies would call us in and say, hey, listen, we have this really big problem called climate change. And we need to find every single professor, every single technology, every single patent. We need to put that in an organization. We really need to start thinking about the fact that we are energy companies, not oil and gas companies. Oil and gas happens to be what we do today, but tomorrow it's probably going to be something else. So everything from advanced materials for nanotechnology, for energy storage and energy artificial leaves, all of these things. And I realized that no one told this to the educators. No one was telling this to schools. So schools were preparing students for today, and they weren't preparing them for tomorrow. So we do a very good job. Like Canada, for example, is in the top 10. We're in the top 10 of countries around the world in terms of education. And that's having the second largest country on the planet, one of the most diverse populations on the planet. Yet we actually even have the highest post-secondary educated population on Earth. But the real sense with a number of parents that I speak to, that they don't feel like the school is really preparing their students for tomorrow. They don't really know what tomorrow looks like. They can't put their hands on it. They can't ask their parents about it, and they feel very anxious about it. And they would probably be right. A lot of schools are doing a very good job at iterations on a 200-year-old model.
I was going to say, you could even make the argument they're not even being prepared for right now. They're being prepared for 50 years ago in some ways. But you know what? I think this is actually a good time to maybe frame what I would call a paradigm in the convo today, which is, what is the purpose of education? Like, do you think that it is simply, you know, to prepare kids to be economic contributors or for that future of work? Or is it to be, you know, the purpose is to be a well and good human, to expand your mind, you know, to be happy? Like, it's no small question, but what do you think is the function of education?
Well, I think the two things that you mentioned are precisely the function of education. The challenge that we have is that we're in a transition. So remember, once upon a time, when we had these TVs that had like the VHS and the DVD player all built into one.
That was
it. Remember those?
Yeah.
So I'm aging myself. So I remember those really well.
Two in one, though? Those were pretty sweet.
And well, here's the thing. Nobody uses any of those things anymore, right? Like, we look at movies now on our iPads or our phones because they're streaming. And so we were trying to anticipate a transition. So at the very beginning of compulsory education, like, for example, here in Canada, Ontario was first in 1871 with compulsory education. And the idea was around nation building. the concept is a Prussian model, and it was around nation building. So the idea was, how do you find a spot for people and how do you categorize them? So you have the people that work in the office and you have the people that work in the factory. Everybody gets paid. That grows the economy because people can go out and consume and buy stuff. And that's had a profound impact on our species for the better. You know, you can chart a direct line to increase IQ, you know, reduction of murder rates, reduction of you know, early death. Like you can, there's so many indicators that show that society was specifically that much better precisely between 1871 and 1900. It hockey sticks like this on maybe about 13 or 14 indicators. But as we have all these iterations, we now get to a place where we start thinking, okay, particularly countries like, you know, developed countries where people have a certain level of comfort. Like it's really, you know, not everybody's doing well, but it's really, really hard to starve to death. Mm-hmm. And let's say Canada, right? There's some places that I've been to where that's not very difficult. But here it's hard to do that here. So we have a certain level. And so now we start thinking about, how do I become a better human being? You know, maybe I don't want to work as hard, right? Like a lot of times people are talking now about self-care and they're talking about, you know, getting to sleep early, working mm-hmm. out, and all these things that are, you know, they're not necessarily perfectly in line with the world of work. Work is about grind. It's about working hard. It's about, you know, it's a Cold War and truce once you start going up higher into your companies. So, you know, work is not a place where you're going to manage your self-care and your self-health and all those kinds of things. And, you know, people talk about going after purpose. The vast majority of people aren't doing something that they believe to be purposeful. They're doing something that's necessary for their prosperity. But now, as people start thinking about, there's an uncomfortable sense of what comes next after this. Mm-hmm. And we're in that transition where we haven't fully gotten to what comes next, but we have this feeling that something should come next and we're trying to figure it out.
So then would you say that the purpose of education then includes both now, that it should be to prepare kids for the future of work and to make them good and well humans?
So the purpose of education now is to be that 2-in-1 TV with VHS and DVD, and to anticipate that's not what's actually going to happen. There's going to be something else. And we can talk a little bit about what I would like that something else to be.
Absolutely.
There's going to be something else.
What do you think it will be?
You know, if we push it all the way through, so we had an inflection point in November 2022, and the inflection point was generative AI. Mm-hmm. And it really lit the world on fire, and it was something that was coming. I did a keynote in 2017. Mm-hmm. And in that keynote 2017, I was showing and talking about something called generative design that was from Autodesk, mm-hmm. which you would type in the parameters of something, you would give it to the AI and it would come back with a design, but it cost hundreds and thousands of dollars to do that. Mm. So only large companies. So Hyundai was using it, and Boeing was using it, ironically, for the doors. In November 2022, the price of that drops by an order of magnitude, right on time, by the way. It drops going along with Moore's Law right on time. And we have this inflection point. And so there's immediately a reaction about, what does this mean for work? Mm-hmm. Because we thought robotics were coming for blue collars. And we didn't think that AI was coming for white collar. And now we realize it's actually coming for white collar first. And it's coming at an interesting time and an interesting financial cycle. And so a lot of the conversation is how do we slow this march?
So to give listeners context, everyone, Dwayne is referring to the public release of ChatGPT by OpenAI in November 2022. And many of you are also using this stuff yourself. So, you know, even if you are not considered the tech person, you probably have some insight or you've heard about or your kids are already using GPT. And that's kind of exactly what Dwayne is referring to, I would imagine.
Yes. And that, you know, it's ChatGPT is one. And, you know, there are literally thousands of other companies that sit on interface. And then there are probably about 10 or 20 other ones that also have their own competing models. And I think as we push this out, if we think that the capability and capacity of this doubles every 2 years, I think as we get 5 years into the future, we're going to start realizing that, you know, an AI chatbot transforms into an AI agent, transforms into a swarm of agents, can be downloaded into a robot, we start to realize a lot of what we do is not necessary, and it's going to be very difficult to hold that back with the pressures of the economic pressures on large companies.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the system is not designed to always look out for the well-being of the individual people in the face of capital gains. However, it's what I think is interesting about the way that you look at this stuff and it comes out in the way that you speak about it. I feel, you know, my judgments have brought me to all the same things that you've just said. And working in digital well-being, of course, I hear a lot of people talk about the downsides of technology, and we'll certainly get into the risks, and we'll certainly get into ethics if we want to. But I take a harm reduction approach in my work too, and I know that you believe this stuff can be good. So before we get into risks and ethics, what would you say are some of the benefits of this kind of technology integrating into, say, the classroom, and we can do the workplace after? And you know what? Even before that, I actually think you're going to have to explain to people the difference between AR, VR, and AI, because I think for many people, it's like, there's a bunch of letters, I don't know the difference, and my kids' teachers keep talking about it.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start off with, you know, let's go with spatial computing. And so inside of spatial computing, you can think of augmented reality and mixed reality. And augmented reality is when you're like, pull this up here. When you're inside of something, right? So you're in this is mine and my son's.
And is that Apple or is that Meta?
No, this is Meta. Apple, if you're looking.
I do have one and I have lots to say.
Yeah. And so this is you're inside a virtual environment and it's immersive and you're disconnected from the world around you. And that immersive environment can be expansive and you can play games in there. You can learn things in there. You can go through experiences in there. So that's virtual reality. Augmented reality or mixed reality, spatial computing, is where you're able to do both. So you can be present in the space and there's things in your environment. So you may, you know, viewers might have seen Apple's Apple Vision Pro. And there you can be in the real world seeing what's going on with digital objects placed in front of you. Or you can be completely immersed inside of the environment itself. And that would be the difference. Now, in terms of artificial intelligence, as it stands right now, it's a massive amount of information that is going through a specific model. It's pulling all that information from everywhere that it can find. So think of the internet, going in and around paywalls, and pulling all that in. And it's using mathematical probability to probabilistically figure out what is the next word based on a question or a prompt or a comment that you've made. And turns out it's actually quite good at doing that. So it feels like we're having a conversation, which is a whole other conversation in of itself. But I want to say this, you know, we were talking about that because we're thinking about technology in the classroom. And classrooms were designed originally around technology. That was the purpose. The purpose of a school was to take a technology that was quite profound and scale it. And the outcome was dramatic. The risk of scaling that technology is actually still the biggest risk that we face today. So that technology is a printed book.
Mm-hmm. And
the biggest risk to human beings today, currently, is heart disease. And heart disease is directly linked to being stationary. So remember at the beginning when I talked about taking the farmer's children off the farm and making them sit for 6 hours?
Mm-hmm.
That's precisely what we do in school, right? Well, one of the prerequisites to be very good at school is to have an ability to sit for about 4 to 6 hours every single day. And, you know,
it seems bizarre when you say it, you know, when you just say it out loud, it's like, how are we expecting four-year-olds to sit uninterrupted?
That's precisely it, right? Like that's the expectation. The expectation is to sit still for as long as humanly possible to master the technology itself. Mm-hmm. And the technology is a printed book. Mm-hmm. So the printed book technology is one of the most profound technologies that we've had because it allows us to, for the first time, connect time and space anywhere in the world that somebody can afford to have a significant amount of books. The limitation with that technology is mobility. You can't carry 1,000 books with you. Mm-hmm. So you have to sit still and you have to show evidence that you've mastered the books for that particular 192-day period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely what we've done with school. And what's the risk? The risk is heart disease. Heart disease still kills more people than war.
Mm-hmm.
It still kills more people than climate change.
Mm-hmm.
It still kills more people than racism. It still kills more people than pandemics.
When I think heart disease, I think older folks. So how does that connect to young people being in school?
Because the sedentary lifestyle compounded over time is one of the things that connects to making your heart very weak. There's a direct connection to sitting down and heart disease versus movement.
So you're saying the lifestyle starts when they're young and then they carry that through.
We sit. Mm-hmm. We sit for,
totally.
I'm sitting right now. We sit in school. We sit at work. We sit in the cars. We sit on the trains. We sit on the planes. We sit. We sit in boxes for a pretty big portion of our life.
Mm-hmm. I relate. Yep. It gives me my lower back issues. So then going back to the more modern technology that we were talking about, the AR, VR, mixed, spatial computing, AI, what would be the benefits of this in the classroom? Like, what's this future that actually we could get really excited about if we did this right?
So, well, I think if we look at the classroom, we may run into a challenge because the classroom is a form factor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a physical form factor. So if I go in most places in the world, I can identify one, right? And you know, if you took a deep breath and closed your eyes, you could identify one too. And some may be more sophisticated than others, but essentially there's this, you know, we're in a cube. There is an adult at the front of the room. There are pupils that are sitting in front of that adult facing the front of the room. There is a major piece of technology from 1801, the blackboard, or an iteration of it at the front of the room and maybe even to the side. So if we want to get fancy. And so that's essentially the classroom. And so when people think about a classroom, that's what they visualize. As a matter of fact, if I go to ChatGPT and I say classroom, it's very, very difficult for ChatGPT not to give me a cube of some form or shape with desks and chairs. I've tried for hours and I haven't gotten saying classroom. Even if I say remove the desk and chairs, it will put it back in.
Yeah.
Right?
I can see that.
it'll put the image back in. And so, you know, so what we should think about is function, right? So the function of learning. So if I now think about, well, how could I use mixed reality or spatial reality for the function of learning? Mm-hmm. Well, that changes dramatically, because now I can say to my son, and we did this back in 2020, I could say, I would like you to look at the Mars rover, and I would like you to use your imagination to think about ways to upgrade the Mars rover. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to build it and go through a series of failures until you get something that you think is really cool. He's able to put on the headset. He's able to see the Mars rover. He's able to play with it in space. He's able to look inside of it. He's able to break it apart, put it back together. He's able to go into a space experience that will allow him to see the context of the Mars rover. Why do we even have one? Where are we going? Where is Mars? Mm-hmm. He's able to do all of that. And then he's able to say, okay, now that I've immersed myself in this environment, I can think about that realistically. When I'm in school, if I say that in school, the student that's sitting in front of me may or may not have context. And so that's a huge advantage to the students who their parents are able to take them places in the summer. They're able to go see different things versus the students that can't go. It's a massive advantage. And that compounds over time.
And in a way, you know, it's a leveler, because everyone gets access to these experiences.
What's a leapfrogger? It's a leapfrogger because
I like that.
What actually happens is someone in a different place can bring themselves to the experience. They don't have to become someone else.
That's right.
Like, they can bring all of their geographical knowledge, their cultural knowledge to that experience, and they're going to be able to see things that I may not be able to see just because of their cultural lens. And that allows them to leapfrog past me.
That, you know, when I got the Apple Vision Pro, and probably similar to you and your son, I was playing with it, and I went into, I think it's called Jig or something, and they had some, you know, it had a race car, they had medical devices, they had a heart, they had all these things that it was one of those experiences where when you experience it for the first time, it's like an immediate knowing that this can change everything. And what you're saying about the rover was my experience with a race car. Like, I'd never thought I was into cars before, but now I can take off the hood and I can go see the engine and I can look at a heart and I can actually see the way that veins move through the heart. And for everyone listening, or if you're watching, it's like, imagine that this thing is right in front of you on your floor and you can move it with your hands. And it's just one of the most incredible experiences.
It's profound. It's, you know, when I first got, we got these in 2020, mm-hmm. and I'm really big into mindfulness, mm-hmm. and meditation, and I could go into an environment and, my gosh, it was profound. Like, you can go into an environment that's so absolutely beautiful, sitting in my unfinished basement amongst the boxes, and being submerged in something that's absolutely beautiful for about an hour. And because I wear a watch, I could see the impact on me as a person. I could see that my resting heart rate dropped. Mm-hmm. I could see that my breaths were different. The way that my body was using oxygen was different. And so I think there are lots of benefits, and there are a lot of things that we know that are beneficial. Mindfulness is one, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like, we know the impact of mindfulness, but it's really difficult to scale in the original form factor that we have. It's difficult for me to sit and say, okay, kids, let's practice mindfulness, but somebody needs to move. There's something on the speaker that comes on. There's something happening outside. It's very difficult to do that in that form factor consistently and get the best results. But we have a number of tools. The tools that we mentioned are some that allow us to do that significantly better, mm-hmm. and scale it.
Well, I think that's one thing that excites me so much about this. When we're talking about the benefits, it's like, why are we not just saying, no, get rid of it right now? It's because of all these things. It's like, regardless of what you believe the purpose of education is, or what you even believe kids should be learning in school, or adults should be learning in school, if you think they should be learning skills, there is a version in soft skills and mindfulness, there's a version of spatial computing and, you know, the VR headsets that can help that. If you think that they should be learning to change a tire because that's a life skill, there's a version that can help that. If you think they should be doing finances better, there is a version that can help that. So it's like, it can help any version of learning that you think kids need to learn.
Yeah, no, and that goes all the way up, right? Like, one of the biggest challenges between work and post-secondary and school is how quickly things change, right? So I can remember when I was in university, I'm going to age myself again, walking into the computer center and saying, I've heard about this thing called the internet. Where do I find it?
That's amazing.
Right? And I mean, I tell this to my son, and he's like, you're lying.
That's absolutely
crazy, right? I go, I know, it doesn't seem that long ago, but I remember this. And from the time that I went and I learned about the internet, there was a course that took a whole year how to build a web page. And by the time I was finished, there were sites that says, yeah, no, just this is a template. And that was in 4 years. And that's way back then.
Wow.
So when you think about how quickly, I look at a lot of the conversations that I have with people online, they're like, you know what, I think this about AI today. I go, but think about how quickly it's moving, mm-hmm. and think about it exponentially. And then when you think how far 4 years is, how far we'll be in 4 years, it's dramatic.
I think so too. I mean, nobody listening should be surprised when AI is as smart as humans, at the very least, as smart, you know, I would say a very, and tell me if you agree, a extremely conservative estimate, like we're saying this is kind of far, would be like 29.
Yeah, 2029, 2030.
And I think that's kind of, like, I think yeah, that's far.
Those are conservative estimates, right? Like, they're very wise people that are wiser than me that say 2029. You know, I'm an advisor with XPRIZE in the learning domain. And the leader of XPRIZE, mm-hmm. is a gentleman by the name of Peter Diamandis, who some of the people may not have heard of. And brilliant guy, you know, future thinking. And he basically gets a lot of wealthy people, smart people all together in the room to try and figure out wicked problems. And, you know, there are a lot of people that were in those rooms that are like 2029.
Oh, yeah.
Here's what I think, something that we don't always pay attention to. We typically don't pay attention to the fact that technology paradoxically increases our sense of humanity. So when content and information become a commodity, mm-hmm. the human becomes the premium. And that's, you know, mm-hmm. how do we know that? Why does anybody go to a concert?
I know that I see a very far, like you think, you know, Hamza as well. It's like I see futures very far in advance where this can actually get us closer to a utopia than we've ever been, and where humans are the premium. But I do know that there are some risks in the short term. So we love the benefits, but what would you say are some of the risks that even would be maybe like unintentional negative outcomes if we did not do this right, of integrating like such technology into, say, the classroom? Or sorry, you know what? Into, say, learning, let's say it right.
Yeah. So I would say our risks at a 50,000 foot view remain the same. So typically what happens is we introduce technology into a space and we get an equation, right? So we get cognitive surplus and physical surplus. Mm-hmm. So we have extra. plus productivity equals transition plus growth. And the risk in there is, what do we do with cognitive surplus? Mm-hmm. As a society today, that's the risk that we're having a conversation about. When we talk about the risk of social media, we're talking about the fact that someone has come along with a strategy to consume our cognitive surplus. They've turned it into a commodity and it's for sale. And we didn't have a plan for our cognitive surplus. And that's it's a massive risk. The other risk is transition, which is, what do we do between one shift to another? What do I mean by that? Microsoft lays off 10,000 people.
And, you know, I think that would be the 10,000, you know, the 10,000, 5,000 foot view that people listening would be more concerned about, and rightfully so and understandably so.
Right. So what do you do in that transition? So to me, the big risks are there, because if you have a large amount of people that are really unhappy with the transition, they're going to let us know about it. And they may not, you know, may not necessarily have a high level of patience in terms of cognitive surplus, right? You know, my son will walk in and, you know, he begs me for a particular social media platform that, you know, they may ban in the States, like every day. And I say, no. He's like, but you're the tech guy. I go, I know. I go, but.
And that's why.
I also am very concerned about, what do you do with that cognitive surplus and that physical surplus? And so, because it has very profound impacts on your health. Mm-hmm. It has profound impacts on your well-being and your sense of purpose. It actually has impact on your motivation and your aspirations, right? So how do you become more intentional about that?
Just to clarify then, you're saying that when you say cognitive and physical surplus, you're referring to the idea that there's going to be a bunch of people with mental capacity and physical capacity that can't use it anywhere?
That, not that they can't, that they don't have a plan for it. So let me give you an example. Let's go to physical surplus. So we'll go to the beginning with the farmer. Mm-hmm. So you're the child of a farmer, and you wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and you work on the farm all day. And then at the end of the day, you go to sleep and you get up and you do it again. But then you go to school. Now you're not working all day, so there's physical surplus. Your body still needs to move. It still has muscles. The healthiest thing for your body is movement, but you're not moving, but you have potential energy. Right? Now with cognitive surplus, you have time, right? You have time to do things mentally. So you have mental space. What do you do with the mental space, right? That you have, the extra mental space. If my son can come in and get AI to do something that would have taken him an hour and it only took him 10 minutes, what does he do with the other 50 minutes?
Right. So you're suggesting then maybe on a societal level, there ought to be a plan for what people should do with their time.
100%. Because what do people do with the extra time right now? If I'll give you a small experiment. Take somebody, put them to wait in a subway or for a plane for an hour and see, what do they do with that cognitive surplus? What do they reach for?
Oh, I know.
Some people reach for a book.
They're going to find some way to entertain and some way to, you know,
that's
100%, right?
That's exactly what you said. You said entertain, right? Mm-hmm. So some people, there are a lot of people that come through a channel or mobile channels and they say, hey, the extra attention and cognitive power that you have, give it to us.
Oh, they're ready. They're ready and waiting.
Give it to us, right? Like, give it to us. We got these really funny videos. You could spend hours in here looking at these funny videos. All you have to do is just flick your thumb up and give it to us. So you, at the same time, there's somebody sitting with a device that's using that cognitive surplus for something very productive. Mm-hmm. Right? There's you can see somebody sitting, you know, there are lots of young people today. I met someone that was in grade 11 and they were making about $150,000 a year with their side business in grade 11. And I thought, my gosh, like he's in class and, you know, at recess, he's just kind of opening up his phone and moving through this and making money. And there are other people that are, you know, looking for funny memes, right? So it really is what do you do with it?
Right. Okay, well, let me give you a thought experiment now, which we might take us out of this classroom realm into some other realms. But I call this one, because this segment is in every episode, where we do a nice little thought experiment where we get to think kind of outside of the constraints of reality, stretch the imagination in whatever way we want. And I called yours Classroom of 2054. And I just decided that 30 years in the future was going to be far enough, but not too far. So it's kind of like, you know, not that important. Imagine stepping into a classroom in 2054. And now that you've already said that you think it might not even be a classroom, let's use the metaphorical classroom or even learning environment. What is the structure? How has technology transformed this learning environment? And then I'm going to even get into like, what does recess look like? Is there recess? Is there breaks? And you could go as wild with this one as you want. So 30 years, what do you think learning environments or dare I say classrooms look like?
So 30 years from now, if I had a genius lamp, this is sort of what I would see. When we were speaking a moment ago about is work for productivity or is it to become a better human? And I said we were in the transition. 30 years from now, I don't think we'll be in a transition. I think we'll be firmly into become a better human. I think we're firmly going to be looking at self-actualization, if we can use that as a term. I don't know how well the idea holds up. You know, this wasn't a very big sample size when Maslow came up with the idea of self-actualization, and I don't think there were any women involved in the study either. But if we look at self-actualization and we hold that as a concept, I think we're going to be focused on self-actualization at scale. And so I think that's huge. And that's going to be very, very different, because right now, when you're very young, it's about learning. When you get to about grade 10, it's about post-secondary education preparation. When you're in post-secondary, it's about learning and discovering. And then at the end of that, it becomes very practical, find a career and get going. But if the vast majority of careers are no longer in the hands of humans, then what would you do? Right? So what would you do if you didn't have to work? I think you would pursue...
One of my favorite thought experiments.
Yeah, you would... I think you'd pursue some form of self-actualization, and that would be rolling, right? So it may be today, I want to be the fittest person in the next 2 years, and I'm going to spend my time dedicated to just that. It may be I may get there and think I'd like to play the violin, and I think it's very beautiful, and I want to do it for its own sake. It may be that I want to paint for its own sake. It may be I want to get into a spaceship and go into the stars. But whatever that self-actualization is, because by 2054, I also believe that we'll be closer to becoming immortal, meaning that we can die, but it's going to be very hard to do it. You know, so if we're by 2054, we're no longer thinking about living to 100. We're now thinking about living to 200, but healthy. So what do you do when that doubles over, right? It's kind of, you know, think about once upon a time when you retired at 65, you're probably going to die at 70. But now you can retire at 55 and have another 40 years of life. And so you have to think about, what do I do with the 40 years of life, right? Like I have to do something to stay vital. So I think we'll spend a lot of time helping young human beings, middle-aged human beings, and older human beings really work on that self-actualization. I think it'd be geographically agnostic. So sometimes we'll be in a classroom, Sometimes we won't. Sometimes we'll be on the move. Sometimes mm-hmm. it'll be real. Sometimes it'll be virtual. Sometimes it'll be holodeck, and a combination of the above. So I think that, then I think, you know, in terms of how we sustain ourselves, I think all of our interactions will contribute to these AI platforms, and that interaction will come back to us in forms of compensation, right? So right now we work for free, mm-hmm. and there's a term for that. Remember I said in 1863, there was the abolition of slavery. And at some point, I think there's going to be another abolition of us working for free digitally, because every interaction mm-hmm. that I have or you have online is extremely valuable to OpenAI, to Microsoft, to anybody building a large language model. Mm-hmm. And we know that it has value because we're seeing that those companies are worth billions. And so if NVIDIA is worth billions of dollars through right. our potential interactions, then we should become shareholders and stakeholders in that, shouldn't we? And we should be paid a dividend for that, shouldn't we? Particularly if it's going to take 60% of our jobs. Somebody said, well, what do you think about universal basic income? I go, well, that's a handout. I go, I'm not interested in a handout. I'm actually doing work. I go, so I'm interested that if I pick up my phone or if I plug on a keyboard, then anything that I'm doing is work. And I should be compensated for my interaction. And if I pursue self-actualization, mm-hmm. then what I'm feeding into the learning language model starts to eliminate bias. It starts to make it a little bit more robust and a little bit more positive if we're all doing that at scale. And that has value for the overall society. So I think the compensation will come that way. And I think in that sense, then we'll probably have to learn a lot to be polymathic thinkers. So we'd have to learn to look at things creativity, to look at what is the intersection between something that's unique. What's unique to Bailey? Because Bailey can grab information from a book. She can grab information like I can grab information. But going through the filter of Bailey is going to put out something that's very different than going through the filter of Duane, and both have value. And so I think, you know, that's what we would learn to do. And then I think the other thing would be pursuing things like the arts, pursuing things like leisure, travel, and pursuing things like spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so I think all of these things, in a nutshell, will be focusing on optimizing life experience in the next 30 years. That's the opportunity. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. It could go very, very sideways because of the risks that we mentioned before. Cognitive surplus and transition could have the whole thing go haywire. But I'm optimistic because historically, mm-hmm. we've always gotten better eventually.
This is why I'm optimistic too. And it definitely doesn't, you know, make me want to erase how people are feeling about the right now. So, you know, for folks listening, when Duane's talking about the cognitive surplus and all this sort of these risks, that is going to be very real risks and very real negative outcomes. And my general thoughts is that it probably will get worse on the ground before it gets better. And the other thing you mentioned, which funny enough came up in the last episode as well, was Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So when Duane's talking, when you're talking about self-actualization, to get there, we will have had to presuppose that your lower order needs have been taken care of, your kind of safety, survival, food, self-esteem, belonging. But so funny, because on the last episode, we talked about how Maslow actually envisioned this as a ladder and not a pyramid, and how you can have parts of yourself in different parts of the pyramid or different parts of the ladder at different times. So I can be self-actualized in one way, but I'm not having certain needs met. And I think it's interesting that in the classroom of 2054, we will be focused on that self-actualization, which includes elements of spirituality, elements of learning, leisure. And I like you're saying, like, if we're going to do this thing called the human experience, how do we maximize the benefits of it, really? It kind of sounds like, is the closest thing to utopia we could get.
And we've been heading in that direction, right? Like we've been, we've been heading in that direction. As horrible as things are, you know, in certain aspects of life today, it's still probably one of the best periods of time to be existing in, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's probably one of the best periods in terms of time to be existing in. Like, you know, my challenge is being able to pay for my place to live. And, you know, I reflect on that challenge while I'm taking a 15-minute hot shower. And, you know, then I come out of that shower, I go into my little wash closet and I flush about 12 gallons of water down. And I come out thinking, gosh, man, I have it really hard, right? I grew up in my lifetime not having any hot water and, you know, having to use the washroom outside, right? So I think a big part of that is because we haven't gotten to where we're going yet, and we need that discomfort at scale to push us there. I think, for example, you know, a lot of the conversation around social media is it's right timed, right? Like it's what, 20 years old? It's brand new, right? Like it's brand new, and we didn't have an idea as to what it was, and now we know, and now we're like, okay, well, what do we do with this? Because it's creating a lot of problems, and it's not any, you know, the difference is speed, right? There were the same problems with books, by the way. If you look at, there's a quote by a chemist. He's a guy that gave us, it's almost like the first encyclopedia. His name is Conrad Gessner, and he is a 16th century chemist. And he's quoted saying there's this technology that it's going to overload our young people with information. It will consume their ability to learn, and it'll destroy society. He was talking about books, right? And so what did we do? We created a strategy for books, and we put that strategy in, and the strategy is called school. And there's certain books that don't go into school, right?
Especially right now.
Well, probably a bad example.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I see what you're saying. Like there was always at some point someone afraid of technology, and there was always at some point someone who used it for good, someone who used it for bad, someone who lost in the short term, someone who gained in the short term. But generally, you know, people seem to adapt and make it work for the better. But, you know, I realize I'm talking in our context here, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah. So then
the technology is one thing. There's a quote from a cartoon character called Pogo, and says, "I've seen the enemy and he is us." And it's the real risk of technology is us.
And, I agree.
And it's not a huge us. It's a small risk, right? Like it's less than 1% of humanity that can have a really big impact. I'll give you a quick.
Right. Human misuse of it.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick
example. Accidentally.
Yeah, so I mentioned before that I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, and Trinidad and Tobago has a very high murder rate per 100,000. But at its very worst, there were 600 murders on the island in its worst year out of an island of 1.2 million. And it's a small island, so that has a huge reverberation. It feels awful. And it's 600 too many. But it's 600, that means that maximum there were 600 murderers in an island of 1.2 million people, which means way over 99% of the people are just happy-go-lucky people, going about their lives, loving their kids, having a good time. Very, very small percentage of that population is creating that harm, but it has such a big impact. And so we're like that now. You know, I look at the news and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's just like so many bad stories. And I count them and I'm like, there's 30 stories on here for 8 billion people. It's a really small amount of stories, right? Like we don't pay attention to the small micro things that we take for granted. We take for granted that even in tough economic times, most people get up and pay a bill at a restaurant. Nobody right. has to. Like you could get up and walk out. We take for granted that the vast majority of people stop at a red light. Like we take all these things for granted because we just expect them. But the vast majority of people are doing the right things and they're positive, good intentioned right. people.
I believe the same. And it when I was kind of reading more about you for our conversation, it came across. This is making me think about one thing that I read, which was one of your talks on stranded brilliance. And it makes me think, you know, everyone's got some version of this. So can you explain what this concept is?
So remember when I talked about sitting under my tree? So this is when I started to think about this concept. And I'm going to give you a little anecdote, and if you will permit me. And
sure. Love me some stories.
To what it is. So when I was about 10, I had a dream of becoming an Olympic athlete. I wanted to swim. And so I started swimming on a swim team in Trinidad and Tobago, and I realized that Trinidad didn't have an Olympic swim team. So at the age of 14, my mother won a scratch card, a lotto scratch card for $1,000. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Hey, Dwayne, you were born in Canada. So you're actually Canadian. Canada has an Olympic swim team. Do you want to go to Canada?" So I said, yes. So she packed me up and she put me on a plane on my own and sent me to Canada. And so I went and I lived with a family friend who is, you know, became like a mother to me. And she was a single mom with three kids. And she took me in as a fourth. And I think she was like 37 at the time. I have no idea how she did that. So I came and I never finished pursuing swimming because I met a young woman and it derailed my entire swimming career. I met a young woman in grade 9 and it derailed my entire swimming career. And I eventually married that woman and had some fun with her. And I think I won out. I would have been swimming against Ian Thorpe, and one of my friends that swam with me in Trinidad was at that final and he came 8th and he was faster than me. So which means there's a high probability that I would not have even made the final and I would not have met my wife. So it worked out fine, but I had the opportunity to go to university. I had the opportunity to go to libraries, mm-hmm. and see lots of books. I had the opportunity to see bookstores. And I think about some of the more brilliant people on my island that didn't have that opportunity. Right? They didn't have that opportunity. The way that our school system is structured, we have a British system. So you write an exam at 11 and you go to three different layers of schools. The top schools are called the prestige schools. Then there are secondary schools and junior secondary schools. And if you went to one of the prestige schools, you're prepared for university. Mm-hmm. University on the island only had room for 1%. So the top 10% went to the prestige schools. Only 1% could get in. So the other 8%, the other 9% would have to try and figure out something to do. If you didn't have
interesting
a path like me to get to another country, you didn't have a scholarship, your brilliance is stranded, mm-hmm. right? And that's around the world at scale. So there's millions and millions of people that fit that. If you're in North America.
Honestly, it makes me... I know a lot of them in my own life, and I had my parents would be in a way stranded brilliance, and they made choices much like your caregivers to allow me to not be.
100%. I mean, even today, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, a story like that one that feels kind of like it's pulling at your heartstrings. Today, if you are in a certain geographic neighborhood, you have a higher probability of success than if you were in another geographic neighborhood in the same city, in the city of Toronto. Mm-hmm. It's measured. There's an index called the LOI index, and it's measured, right? Like you can see these probabilities. And so I think that's stranded. And here's the last one. Right? I mentioned my wife. When I met my wife, she was having a difficult time with English and what was called OAC, aging myself again, which is grade 13. Mm-hmm. We no longer have grade 13. She was having a difficult time with OAC English. And, you know, she was really struggling through it. She's having a difficult time writing. And I would try to help her and all of this. And not too long ago, This is decades later. You know, she says to me, you know, I got 98% in calculus, in OAC calculus. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
98%, no tutor, no extra help, nobody. You were able to pull off a 98% on your own, working as well. I go, that's like genius level stuff, right? I go, and her brilliance was stranded because she felt that because this part wasn't doing very well, that this part was irrelevant. And so I think all of those scaled. And the last example of it would be work. There are a lot of people that have come into work and there's so much opportunity in their head that doesn't have a space in their function. And there's no real way for their managers or for their boss to have a system to unlock that. And so it's stranded. Right? Stranded doing one thing, but there's so much value that they can deliver doing something else. And so I think when we look at that at scale, it's huge. And why do I think that's important? I think it's important because the last time that we unlocked stranded brilliance at scale was in 1871. And the impact on humanity was absolutely profoundly positive. And today, post-secondary, we're at about a 30 to 50% success rate in terms of people going and getting a post-secondary credential. So that means that we have, if we use that as an indicator, and it's not the only KPI, but let's use that as a KPI, that means that we're about 50 to 70% inefficient in terms of the amount of solutions that are stranded in human beings out of 8 billion people.
Well, I mean, this brings me to your segment for this episode, because everyone gets a different one. And hearing stranded brilliance, I had to choose for you wishful thinking, where we can just come up with some hopes, dreams, aspirations, optimistic speculation. And I thought, if you could make one change across the country, so we can say Canada, to unlock stranded, oh, did I say standard? I meant stranded brilliance. Perhaps the opposite. Stranded brilliance in people. What could that one change be? That's a lot of people, but what do you think that one change could be to better unlock stranded brilliance?
I think the one thing that I would change, or the one, so it's almost like leveraging the Pareto principle and looking for the choke point. I think the choke point is the relationship between post-secondary education and, no, let me say that, physical post-secondary education and employment.
Interesting. Highest, so not even high school?
No. So the highest, the choke point is physical post-secondary education. And let me explain. A physical space to get into university is finite. So the demand is finite, but much bigger, right? So there might be 10,000 people that want to get into, I'll pick on a school, UFT engineering. So you need to have about a 98 to 100%, probably a 99 to 100% to even be considered. And at 99%, you could not be considered. And a big component of that is physical space, right? So physical space and exclusivity. So I know a lot of schools talk about, you know, being inclusive, but school, as it's designed right now, is designed fundamentally to be exclusive.
True.
It's, you're going through exclusion, like different hoops of exclusion. And so I think that choke point is a problem. Now, because it's the highest probability of success, there are three things in a system for it to work really well. People need to have confidence, trust, and optimism. And so most parents, they kind of aim their kids one way or another to do some kind of post-secondary education. And they have confidence, trust, and optimism that is going to give the highest probability of success at scale to their child. So they will do all kinds of creative things. They'll use VR and stuff in elementary school, and they'll love all those things. But by about grade 10, parents, schools, everybody get really focused on what is post-secondary preparation, whether that be university, college, or some kind of training. What's that going to be? And everybody gets very, very serious about that. And that's the choke point. Mm-hmm. I think if there is a release of stranglehold on employment or the future of work from post-secondary, I think we'll see an explosion of learning. If, as a parent, I were confident and I was optimistic and I had trust that there was another credible pathway for my child to take for prosperity that would scale, I would do it. Right now, what we have is exceptionality, right? Maybe you could be a hockey player. Maybe you could be a basketball player, become a millionaire. You know, maybe you can, but you can be exceptional. You could be an exceptional, you know, entrepreneur, right? Be an entrepreneur and become exceptional. There's maybe, you know, 200 exceptional entrepreneurs that we can think of and probably about 10 that we can name. So it's not scalable, right? As a basketball player, there are only 400 jobs in the NBA for a player, right? And you're competing against 5-6 million people. So it's not scalable. But if there was a way for us to do that while building in confidence, trust, and optimism into that pathway, I would throw a massive amount of energy into that, because I think that would unlock other people to be creative and come up with other solutions. And I think that's happening right now as we speak.
I think so too. But to be clear, in our wishful thinking, the one thing that could be done to probably unlock the greatest amount of stranded brilliance would be to actually make higher ed inclusive, like to make it actually inclusive.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even say to make it inclusive. I would say to make a number of different a series of credible pathways to prosperity between K to 12 and the world of work.
Okay.
And so it doesn't necessarily need to be university. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, if I could go to a training course and I could have a swarm of AI agents with me that essentially turned me into CEO of a small consulting firm, and somewhere around grade 10, I could get super awesome at that, then I would pursue it. I'll give a quick personal example. I hired someone to do, we're keynote speakers, and so I really need like a really cool reel. And so I hired someone to do a really a video shoot for me, and it took them about a month to, you know, get the video, edit the video, put it all together. And I said, you know, I want to do these often. And it took me about a month. I paid a chunk of money for it. And then I thought, gosh, boy, if I had to do this if it took a month every time, that would be like 12 times, 12 things, right? And that's not enough.
Right.
And my son comes along and he says, oh, let me see all your clips, some of your clips and your stuff. And it takes him 30 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. He pumps out something that I posted onto LinkedIn, and, you know, I said, oh, you know, this is something that my son did. And within the day, maybe four people reached out and said, can I hire him and he's 14.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, in his mind, he's like, what am I doing with that? I go, say yes. I go, and this is what you're charging. Right. And
say yes, kid. Let me teach you a lesson.
That I'm not buying. I go, this is your shot. Right. And so, but right away, and I think to myself, I'm like, you know, maybe he's into it, maybe he's not. But if he's in grade 11 and he's able to do this while he's in grade 11 and make himself thousands of dollars, you know, if for some reason, you know, he sort of hit a brick wall or something in terms of academics, but was able to turn this into, now it's, I have confidence that he can be prosperous as an adult. Mm-hmm. I have confidence in the path. I now have confidence that there's all these different courses that he can continue to take And it negates the need for him to have a general degree. He still is going to need to go to university if he wants to be a doctor or a surgeon, but a general degree to go work for someone, mm-hmm. it really is about, you know, being a polymathic thinker, being a problem solver, mm-hmm. and being able to, you know, to work on teams with people.
So, well, as we are getting to the end here, then I want to give you the last segment called Train of Thought, which is connecting what we've talked about this episode to the last one and how they summed it up. And this has been going since the beginning. So I'll first ask you, what do you think would be the main idea from our talk today?
I think the main idea of our talk would be to cognitively reframe education mm-hmm. and future possibilities.
Okay, so to cognitively reframe education and the future possibilities, you have to connect this to the theme of the last episode. Okay. Now, the theme that they produced was, conveniently, happiness is a skill that can be learned, is how they summed up our discussion. So how would you connect happiness as a skill that can be learned to our chat?
Sure. So I think to be happy, you have to consider how you view something and how you frame it. So when we're taking in information, we have an event and we have an emotional response to that event. And it's almost like a cookie. Right. So when we have events that are similar, we have similar emotional responses. And I think when we reframe things cognitively, we're able to see possibilities, new possibilities, and those new possibilities give us a sense of a compelling future. And progress towards any compelling future, I think, makes us happy.
Well, I love it. And this will be an interesting one for the next guest to have to connect. So is there anything else, any last piece of advice that you want to give to listeners before we go?
My advice would be this. There are a lot of things that are happening in the world, and a lot of them are very concerning. And I'm wary of the challenges, but I'm radically optimistic about the possibilities. And so my advice would be to people is I challenge them to not to be a positive thinker or anything like that, but to cognitively reframe what they see and see where is the possible upside to what's in front of them. And the last thing that I would say is if life is a massive tapestry and all of it is true, I would focus on the parts of the tapestry that give me the most joy and not assume that the other parts don't exist, but they're just not within my focus. I would spend time focusing on that. And I think if we did that, I think we'd find ways to improve many of the situations and circumstances that we see that we don't like. That would be my advice.
Well, I love it. And on that note, thank you, Dwayne, for coming here and thinking some things through with me this evening.
And thank you very much for all the thoughtful questions and really kind of forcing me to stretch myself on a Friday afternoon. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate good conversations and good questions. Thank you very much for that.